now welcome to Oasis Forum, where we explore issues that can help us positively evolve our lives, our society, and our planet. Oasis Forum features authors, activists, artists, and healers working to increase our appreciation of the interconnectedness of life on Earth. Each week, we explore a new topic that impacts our health, our families, our communities, our work, and our environment. Our goal is not just to discuss present challenges, but to develop an awareness of root causes and, importantly, to explore potential solutions. At Oasis Forum, our aim is to inspire hope and share practical ideas for creating a world that works for all. And good evening. This is John Michael Dumais. You are listening to Oasis Forum on this beautiful Sunday evening in April. And we have a very special guest tonight coming in over the wire from California. His name is Jim Garrison. He is the author of America as Empire, Global Leader or Rogue Power, and several other books that I'll mention in a minute. Jim was born in Sichuan Province, China, in 1951. He lived with his family in Taiwan from 1953 till 1965 before they came over to California. And he went to college at Pepperdine University, attended the University of Tel Aviv, and received a BA in World History from Santa Clara University, and continued on when most of us would have stopped to get a double MTS in Christology and History of Religion from Harvard Divinity School and a PhD in Philosophical Theology from Cambridge University. As a student at Harvard, Garrison became engaged in the anti-nuclear movement and in the citizen diplomacy movement to reduce tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union. And he found two organizations dealing with these issues, the Radiation and Health Information Service and East-West Reach. In 1980, he published his first book, The Plutonium Culture. This was followed by The Darkness of God, Theology After Hiroshima, The Russian Threat, Myths and Realities, The New Diplomats, Civilization and the Transformation of Power, and in 2004, the book I mentioned, America as Empire, Global Leader or Rogue Power. From 1986 to 90, Garrison served as executive director of the Esalen Institute Soviet American Exchange Program, which engaged in private sector diplomacy with Soviet counterparts in a variety of sectors. In 1991, he founded the International Foreign Policy Association in collaboration with Georgian President Edward Shevardnadze and former Secretary of State George Shultz, focusing on providing humanitarian relief for children in the former Soviet republics. In 1992, at the behest of Mikhail Gorbachev, Garrison founded and became president of the Gorbachev Foundation USA. These two organizations set the stage for the establishment in 1995 of the State of the World Forum, a San Francisco-based nonprofit institution created to establish a global network of leaders dedicated to these principles, values, and actions necessary to guide humanity towards a more sustainable global civilization. With President Gorbachev as its convening chairman and Garrison as its president, the forum convened leaders from around the world in a spectrum of disciplines to its annual and regional conferences and catalyzed the creation of several independent organizations. Garrison now serves as the president of Wisdom University in Oakland, California, which was founded in 1996 by Matthew Fox, a Dominican theologian, expelled from his order for his wisdom-based theology of creation spirituality. The university has developed a highly diverse and comprehensive curriculum of the study of the world's wisdom traditions. It is also focused on how wisdom can engage catalytically in the development of new forms of spirituality, as well as in the solution of contemporary challenges, particularly the rise of religious fundamentalism. So with that rather lengthy introduction, I'm going to ask Jim if you are with us now.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for joining us. And the reason why, one of the reasons why I went through that rather lengthy introduction was because I wanted to give our listeners a feel for your background. And even though you've been involved with books that seem fairly sociological and political, you've been through a variety of paths or a variety of tributaries on your path, shall we say, which I think gives you a unique perspective into the development of America as empire and in global issues. So thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
And I guess the first thing I'd like to know is how you define empire, and is America really an empire? Can you give us a quickie overview on that?
Yes. Historians define empire as a nation that controls at least two other nations, either informally through various mechanisms of dominance or formally through annexation and direct military and political control. if you consider the dominance that the United States exercises over the Western Hemisphere from Canada down to Chile since 1823 and the promulgation of the Monroe Doctrine, the influence and dominance the United States has in Western Europe through the NATO alliance over the last 60 years, the dominance that the United States exercises throughout the global South through the mediating institutions such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization, I think it's safe to say that the United States controls more nations, more peoples in more ways than any empire, probably in the history of the world. The fact that we could exercise our military strength in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, literally on the other side of the planet and dispense with those two nations in fairly quick order is a measure of our military. But I think it's also important to realize that the United States dominates the world politically, economically, financially, scientifically, technologically, culturally, and ideologically, and does so in every category of comparison. So to call the United States an empire is not a judgment against the United States. It's merely a statement of fact, and I think it's the fact that the United States, that the American public, have not really understood this and come to terms with the magnitude of American power in the world today is one of the reasons that we find ourselves in the predicament that we currently are, where we are bewildered that most of the world community is seriously concerned about the way the United States is dispensing its power, and I think is bewildered at the actions of the United States, which is characterized by an increasingly militarized foreign policy formation.
So why is it then that the United States citizenry seems to be so unaware of its impact in the rest of the world?
Well, I think, you know, all peoples, as I travel around the world, are basically insular. Whether you're in Canada or you're in Europe or you're in Thailand or you're in Africa, most people comport their personal lives and with their families and their immediate relationships. And the news is only interesting to them if it impinges in some kind of a direct way. Otherwise, it's more background noise. And, you know, if you're living in Canada or you're living in Holland or you're living in Hong Kong, that's okay. But if you happen to be living in the greatest empire in the history of the world, it's incumbent on you to be more aware so that you can take more responsibility for the power that you exercise. And I think the fact that the American people are not doing that today and, in fact, forfeiting their civil liberties and civic responsibilities in the manner in which we currently observe around us, that really is a danger sign for the longevity of the American empire. Remember, all empires go up, they flourish for a while, and they decay. That's what historians call the imperial arc. Empires can last an amazingly long period of time, like Rome that stood for 1,000 years, or they can last an amazingly short period of time, for example, like the Nazis that destroyed themselves after only 12 years. So how a nation gains its power, but more importantly, how a nation maintains its imperial power is an extraordinarily important question for it to very consciously take up, so that it doesn't become, as someone observed of the British Empire, merely an accidental empire sleepwalking through history.
Now, I know you've studied ancient civilizations and the Roman Empire, as you just mentioned. What would you, you know, tell somebody who doesn't necessarily have a lot of background in history, but may have, you know, a good liberal education or something? How would you point out what's going on in the United States and relate it to earlier empires? And what are the danger? What are the danger signs that earlier empires showed that that we're not seeing necessarily, that have, you know, some bases or parallelisms in what's going on in the United States today?
Well, I think the first way that I would answer that is to start with Rome. If Rome lasted the longest, Rome clearly figured out certain principles of imperial governance that stood it in very good stead as it reigned an extremely diverse empire from England all the way to Persia and the Indus River. And what the Romans learned about empire is that it is not about how forcefully you can conquer and dominate people through the power of your legions. It has much more to do with how skillfully you can universalize law. The Romans in mythology are about the power of their legions and their practical construction of their aqueducts and their roads and so forth and so on. But what really held the Roman Empire together was the universal application of Roman law. Mm-hmm. And they had a real genius for building institutions that the governed perceived to be fair. And, you know, at the high point of the Roman Empire, people the length and breadth of the imperium participated in the Roman Pax Romana, mm-hmm. With real enthusiasm and participatory inclusion. And I think that if you look at what Roosevelt and Truman did 60 years ago, you find that that was an extraordinarily Roman way to build the American imperium. On one level, they were taking on the Germans and the Japanese and fighting a two-front war across the Atlantic and the Pacific, and they prevailed and forced their adversaries to unconditional surrender like the Romans did time after time as they built and maintained their imperium. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, these two presidents built the United Nations. They built the Bretton Woods institutions, mm-hmm. the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. They built the Marshall Plan. They built NATO Alliance. And before he left office, Truman established the General Agreement on Trades and Tariffs that evolved over time into the World Trade Organization. If you look around the world today, mm-hmm. almost all the international institutions and the international norms and procedures were established by U.S. presidents using the national sovereignty of the United States to do a very Roman accomplishment, and that is to build institutions that the governed essentially perceive to be fair.
That's right.
The characteristic of the Bush administration that so alarms the international community is that he has withdrawn from more treaties and protocols and agreements than any president in the history of our republic. Mm. He's marginalized the United Nations. He's deconstructed the international system of laws. He attacked Iraq against the express wishes of the Security Council and in violation of international law. Mm. And he's replacing the matrix of international law with a basically anarchistic system of what he calls the coalition of the willing, mm-hmm. and the international community that has relied on the United States for 100 years to lead it, mm-hmm. in building the global governing mechanisms for an increasingly globalizing world, stands back in awe and bewilderment and increasing consternation that, mm-hmm. this country is forfeiting that very ancient, ultimately Roman notion of how you govern an empire. That is embraced rather than fought by its people.
Mm-hmm. So if the empire that we are is threatened in any way, how do you see that happening? How do you see that, the series of steps, maybe if things do not change course, or perhaps things should change course, because you mentioned at another point in your book that perhaps we are at the end of the era of the nation state. So I'm wondering if you could speak to, what this transformation point looks like. And secondarily, how do we deal with the, I think, still large amount of people here in the United States, at least, that seem skittish about anything having to do with the UN or international agreements? They seem very skittish about losing their sovereignty.
Well, I observe in America as empire what I think is the single most important fact for all Americans to understand, and that is that there's a deep irony about the situation in which the United States finds itself. We are reaching our apogee moment and have become the strongest nation in the history of the world, right at the moment when history is moving beyond the nation state. And that disequilibrium between being the strongest nation state right at the moment when history is moving beyond the nation state is exaggerating our power simultaneously while it undermines our power. So the image that I offer for the United States right now is a mighty fortress on shifting sand.
Mm-hmm.
If you look around the world today, there's between 20 and 30 major global challenges ranging from ozone depletion, global warming, overfishing, deforestation, water scarcity, HIV/AIDS and other pandemics of infectious diseases, organized crime, terrorism, overpopulation, persistent poverty, all kinds of financial and economic issues, of the absence of any international property jurisdictions, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
None of these problems are being solved. All of these problems are chronic.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are acute. Many of them are metastasizing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a connection, for example, between the fact that we're experiencing tsunamis, increasingly haphazard and erratic climactic conditions, pandemics of infectious diseases,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that we're not dealing with global warming.
Mm-hmm.
All the scientists predict that these things will escalate unless we come to terms with global greenhouse emissions. There's
mm-hmm.
a connection between terrorism, failed states,
mm-hmm.
And the fact that we're not dealing with persistent poverty. Do you know that two-thirds of the human race has never even made a telephone call?
Mm. Wow.
35,000 children die every 24 hours because of completely preventable water-related and poverty-related diseases.
Mm.
And so the United States, right at the moment, even as Woodrow Wilson after World War I and Roosevelt and Truman after World War II, we are in a third great crisis of globalization. And the fact that the United States and many Americans, as you indicate, are putting their head in the sand
mm-hmm.
and saying, we don't want to have anything to do with the international community, and we want to go out there and through force of arms conquer the Afghanis, conquer the Iraqis, go after the Iranians, take on the Syrians, dispense with the United Nations, deconstruct the World Bank. We are right now spending more on military procurement, literally,
mm-hmm.
than the rest of the world combined, and we're forfeiting the real challenge of any empire that seeks to leave a legacy of greatness, and that is to build institutions that are perceived as fair. If the United States would build the third iteration of global institutions in the spirit of Roosevelt and Wilson,
mm-hmm.
we could be the final empire, because the next iteration of global institutions would be so strong that it would make obsolete the need for empire. And I believe that we could become, if we would consciously see ourselves as a transitional empire,
mm-hmm.
that we would go down in history as the final empire that really chose at its moment of choice to midwife the next iteration of global, hopefully democratic institutions,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Rather than to do what the Nazis and the Assyrians and the many other empires have done,
mm-hmm.
which I think is the great mistake of the Bush administration,
mm-hmm.
and that is to think that strength comes out of the barrel of a gun.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't. It resides ultimately in the hearts and minds of the people you seek to include.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, we're going to take a brief break and be back in a couple of minutes. We have been here speaking with Jim Garrison, the president of Wisdom University, and the author of America as Empire, Global Leader or Rogue Power. Thanks for joining us, and stick around. We'll be right back.
Keeping healthy year-round. An important way for you to stay healthy is to be up to date with vaccinations. Anytime is a smart time to think about immunizations. It's not just about going back to school or preparing for flu season. It's 24/7 because vaccines save lives and reduce illness and disability. Throughout the year, the National Partnership for Immunization asks people of all ages, are you up to date? Vaccinate. For more information, contact your healthcare provider or visit www.partnersforimmunization.org.
The Wellness Support Group meets every second Wednesday of each month at Life Arts in Keene from 7 to 8:30 p.m. You can reach Carol Gardner at 357-4699 for more information and details, or walk right in and join the group. That's the Wellness Support Group. It meets every second Wednesday of the month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Call Carol Gardner at 357-4699 for any more details.
All right, and we are back with Oasis Forum, and we are speaking with Jim Garrison, president of Wisdom University in California, author of America as Empire, Global Leader or Rogue Power. And before we took a break, we were touching into the subject of America's possibility of moving beyond the nation state. And, Jim, I would like to ask you to paint us two pictures. One picture is, without, you know, being overly negative, but one picture is if we don't change course, what do you see are the next likely symptoms of our taking this course, and what could be done given the current administration and the current climate in the United States? What do you think could be done as a next step? And then finally, I guess the third part of the question is, what could these global institutions look like, and how could they work democratically, as you suggest, given the size of the world we have? How can we begin to structure those institutions?
Okay, well, let me start with the first one. I think that the real danger in the world today is the conflation of what I call theological apocalypticism with secular apocalypticism. The irony of American power is, right as we become the strongest nation in the world, there are tens of millions of American evangelical Christians that believe this is the end of the world.
That's right.
And the fact that the President of the United States counts himself as one of them is a major part of our current predicament.
Mm-hmm.
We have an extraordinary vortex of theological and political power emanating out of the Christian right that believes that we are at the end of time, and that the establishment of the nation state of Israel in 1948 was the harbinger of quite literally the last generations of human beings that inhabit this planet before Jesus comes again in a great rapture and everybody who believes that goes to heaven and everybody else is sort of consigned to perdition.
Mm-hmm.
And so the worse the situation gets for these people, the more expectant they become. Mm-hmm. So that with environmental devastation, that's just one of the signs of the end. If there's ecological or economic devastation, that's just another sign of the end of time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people have believed that it was the end of the world, you know, for a very long time. In every generation, there's always a few kind of people on the lunatic fringe who believe that, sell their property and go to the top of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
The end has never come, but we are in a situation where there's any number of triggering mechanisms emanating from the 20 to 30 global challenges to which I referred in the last section of the program that could really destroy the world as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
Look at weapons of mass destruction. Look at epidemics of infectious diseases. Look what just happened with the tsunami. Look at the cascade of issues that are emanating out of our refusal to deal with global warming.
Yes.
But I predict if we maintain the current course as charted by the Bush administration and embraced by the evangelical right, is we're going to see a rising crescendo of global in scope crises leading to a catastrophe that will be at the magnitude probably of the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
But while the First World War and the Second World War came out of the conflict between nations for ideological reasons, I believe that this next catastrophe is going to emanate from the ecology itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that we're on an extremely dangerous road. And the fact that the Bush administration seems intent on building a national security state here and maintaining a very highly aggressive and militarized foreign policy abroad,
mm-hmm.
backed up with the Christian right, which dominates the Republican Party and has a grip on Washington, and if you take it further, the fundamentalists that grip the United States today in terms of the instrumentalities of power are replicated in Israel with the extreme religious right dominating the Likud party and the nation state of Israel, and are replicated again with the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia and Al-Qaeda and the militant extremists throughout much of the Islamic world. Fundamentalism is on the rise in the Abrahamic religions. Fundamentalism also is present in Hinduism and Buddhism. If I had to characterize the single greatest threat to human stability and peace today, I would say it's the growing tide of religious fundamentalism. Now, that's one picture. If the United States would deepen its connection with the wisdom tradition, and this is one reason why I've left the State of the World Forum and I'm now working as the head of Wisdom University. It's a very interesting characteristic about wisdom that is worth considering. Wisdom is omnipresent. It's available to everyone everywhere because it emanates out of the created order itself. But the ancient Jews discerned a very specific and peculiar characteristic of wisdom, and that is that it also emanates very specifically with a particular potency at one particular moment in the historical process, and that's the moment of apocalypse. That's what the Jews discovered between the 3rd and 1st century B.C. when they went through their own apocalyptic period. And on the one hand, many of their Orthodox fundamentalists, the Hasidic communities, began to expectantly look for God to break through history, destroy the world, and recreate Jerusalem and a new heaven and a new earth over which they would rule, just like the evangelical Christians believe it's going to happen today. Jesus is going to come down and everything is going to change. But God never did that. Instead, other seers had visions of what they called Chokmah, translated into the Greek as Sophia, which was the beginning of the wisdom tradition in Judaism. And that was that wisdom tradition that said, no, God is not going to break through history and destroy the world. What needs to be changed is your own heart. That the renewal that you seek is not going to come through destruction, but is going to come with the alignment, the realignment of the human psyche and soul with the ordering principle of creation. And that's how they defined wisdom, was the ordering principle of creation. So wisdom begins to emanate at a time of societal collapse where all around us we see, as the theologians have often observed, that truth is on the scaffold and evil sits on the throne. And it looks like everything is headed toward destruction and despair. That's when wisdom moves, and that's when she begins to breathe. And in fact, as the Proverbs say, and Job and other books of the Old Testament say, she shouts from the rooftops and from the city gates, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. No one comes into the Father but by me. And I think that that spirit is desperately lacking, and that's why I've joined a university that has dedicated itself to really learning about the wisdom traditions of all the great religions, because in every great religious tradition, there's a dialectical tension between those that are sectarian and fundamentalist.
That's right.
And exclude and divide in order to say we are right and you are wrong, and those who say that it's not about being saved, it's about participating in a great mystery, and it's about the transformation, an alchemical transformation of the human soul from a base metal like lead into gold. And that is what I think we really need to look at. And I would say more broadly, as someone who has degrees, as you mentioned before, from places like Harvard and Cambridge, you know, if you look at the universities today, they're career factories.
Yes.
They're about knowledge. And all the tests you'll ever take at a university is based on how well you can memorize certain bits of information. And if you have a good memory, you can make straight A's. They are not about learning. They are not about wisdom. Remember in Greek philosopher means lover of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And what the wisdom meant for the ancient Greeks and also for the ancient Hebrews, it was not about knowledge. It was the integration of intelligence with compassion.
Mm-hmm.
It was understanding that all the cosmos is one, and we, as part of the created order, are part of a singularity. And if you understand your oneness with it and overcome your desire to divide us against them and see yourself as chosen and the other people as consigned to perdition, you all of a sudden have a compassion for your fellow human beings
mm-hmm.
that just emanates like a wellspring out of your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when real learning takes place, in my judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're developing this university and beginning a whole program in the fall of what we're calling mystical activism, where
wow.
we're taking people on pilgrimages to holy sites, beginning to a pilgrimage of the holy site of Mary Magdalene and the Black Madonna in southern
mm-hmm.
France.
Right.
And then in the spring, having a similar program of service where they're going to Calcutta with the missionaries of charity or in Afghanistan or the Sudan,
mm-hmm.
places of extreme deprivation and duress,
mm-hmm.
So that the students at Wisdom University really come to see that it's mystical activism, it's learning, it's integrating your intelligence with compassion
mm-hmm.
that really is what higher education should be all about.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that even as Wisdom overcame the apocalyptic tendencies of the Jews 2,300 years ago,
mm-hmm.
It has always overcome and led humanity down its path, even if a great cataclysm was experienced.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the refusal of this community to really listen to its very soft voice.
And thank you for saying the very soft voices. That was exactly what was going through my mind as you were talking. When I think of mysticism, I tend to think of softness. I tend to think of soft heart. I tend to think of pluralistic attitudes and approaches to things. And I'm wondering, given the fact that, you know, the media is largely, in my view, controlled by the right, and it seems to be a mouthpiece for separative, divisive viewpoints, how do you see this softer voice breaking through that megaphone, shall we say?
Well, you know, one of the great truths of not only the Bible, but most of the deep religious traditions is that when the powerful believe that they are so powerful that they no longer need to act with humility and they can rely on brute force, that's where the spirit of wisdom and the spirit of God begins to very subtly move. And the classic story, of course, is the, you know, Moses in ancient Israel. You know, the Pharaoh ruled supreme.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews had been enslaved in Egypt for 400 years. And then one of the mothers just put her son in the bulrushes, in a little ark, you know, covered with pitch, at a moment when the Pharaoh was saying that all the Jewish mothers had to kill their firstborn son.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of the highly paradoxical realities of Israel, it was the daughter of the Pharaoh that saw little baby Moses floating down the Nile. And the man that was going to bring Pharaoh down lived in Pharaoh's house for 40 years,
yeah.
and Pharaoh never saw him because he was so full of his own pride.
Mm-hmm.
And then at a certain moment, the spirit moved, and Pharaoh was felled,
mm-hmm.
and the people of Israel were delivered, not by their own strength, not by their own force of will, but by the soft, breaking presence of the will of God that took them out of Egypt, across the Red Sea, and into Canaan. And there's one of the beautiful things about Christmas and the beautiful things about Jesus. Jesus of Nazareth has had more influence than perhaps anybody in all of human history, and he was born in a manger. And the deepest truth about Christmas is that things that are small, if they're guided by the Spirit and cultivated in humility, they have a way of selling the Roman Empire. And one of the great ironies of Pontius Pilate condemning Jesus to die on Good Friday, just passed a few weeks ago, is that Pilate had no idea that the man that he was condemning to die was one day going to subvert and bring down the mighty Roman Empire. So when we talk about wisdom, we're talking about the most powerful force in the world. And yet it's the softest force. And all we can do in our personal lives is embody it. Because it is directed not by human choice and human will. It's directed by the spirit that guides the affairs of all of humankind. And so we look at the media, we look at the Bush administration, we look at, you know, the fundamentalists, and we look at it all and we say, how can this be overcome? And all we can do, like the wisdom keepers of old, is fall to our knees and just day by day live out who we are in humility, and sooner or later the Spirit is going to move in ways that we cannot even imagine.
Now, I know that Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama have spoken in recent years of a need for political activism on the part of spiritual individuals, or individuals, you know, drawn to spiritual practice and the spiritual path. And, you know, what you're talking about sounds still to me like spiritualism or spirituality, the soft-heartedness is being in the moment. But do you see, in addition to this, some kind of ways in which people can come together in that activism that you're talking about as a group? And I think of the World Social Forum as an example of, you know, citizens just coming together saying, hey, wait a minute, this is our world. But do you see any kind of movement that would give you hope at this collective level? Well, what could you point to happening right now in the world that gives you hope that that Sophia, this wisdom tradition, is starting to emerge?
Well, I think that one of the most potent signs of hope is the growing rise of the NGO community worldwide. I mean, if you've any NGOs, and it's really interesting to me that right at the moment when the United States dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and began the era of nuclear weapons and made our weaponry so lethal it was almost impossible to use, and we became sort of like the saber-toothed tiger, all around the world there began an outpouring of the Spirit, and now there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of NGOs that are really all in their own way shepherding various aspects of how you protect the planet. Look at all the environmental NGOs. Look at the NGOs that are looking at the World Bank and the IMF. Look at the NGOs that are involved in human rights violations. I mean, every domain of human endeavor now is full of very conscientious, good-hearted people that are taking one small little piece and saying, you know, this is important, this is where I'm going to dedicate my life. And I'm always struck that whenever, you know, the rich and the powerful try to do something, it used to be they could just do it and get away with it. Now, they've got, you know, dozens of NGOs that are all over them. And so if Nike starts to engage in slave labor in northern Thailand, you know, 20 years ago, nobody even knew it was happening. All Americans cared about is they were getting. And now everything is being increasingly transparent. And I would say that the most important transformation of that I think is going to be the solution we all seek and we all need is the growing power of the NGO community and the gradual inclusion of the NGO community in the kind of the instrumentalities of governance. Right now, we're in crisis because we have government, not governance. And if you look at the World Bank, the IMF, the World Bank, even the U.S. Congress, it's all we're sending individual representatives to these places to make decisions sort of on our behalf. I believe that was very important in the 18th century when it was developed. It's no longer relevant for the 21st century. And just to very quickly, because I know we're running out of time, but to give two examples of what I mean, when Ruud Lubbers was Prime Minister of Holland between 1982 and 1994, Holland, when he came to power, was plagued by environmental paralysis. And like here in the United States, the environmentalists and the corporations would lobby the parliament in Holland, and nothing would get done, and the legislation that was finally voted through was a compromise, and it ended up perpetuating the problems rather than solve it.
Mm-hmm.
So Ruud Lubbers turned it on its head, and he said to the environmentalists and the corporations, listen, we have a problem. In their case, it was with all the waste from the pigs that are grown all over Holland.
Mm-hmm.
And what are you going to do with it? And he says, you folks sit down, take your time, take a year, take 2 years, and come up with a recommendation that you both agree with. Then you submit it to the parliament, and I'll make sure it gets passed. And guess what? 18 months later, the environmental groups and the corporations came to the parliament and said, we think this will solve your problem. It was passed, and the problem was, in fact, solved.
Mm-hmm.
New Zealand has now taken that on, and more countries in Europe are beginning to look at it, where they're just redefining democracy for the 21st century. Another example is what Lloyd Axworthy, the Prime Minister of Canada between 1994 and 2001, did on the landmine treaty.
Mm.
When he came in, he said to the Prime Minister, Mr. Chrétien, I want to solve one problem as long as I'm going to be foreign minister. I want to do the landmine treaty. And Chrétien and everybody says, you're crazy. You're never going to get anything through the UN, and the U.S. is going to veto it in any event. So Lloyd said, well, let's just redefine governance here. Let's see if there's another way to do it. He went to the National Association of Vietnam Vets in Washington, which is a big NGO,
mm-hmm.
and he said, listen, why don't we partner? You start mobilizing the NGO community. I'm going to start organizing the nation states,
mm-hmm.
and let's meet in a year, and let's just design our own treaty.
Mm-hmm.
It had never been done before. He did not go through the United Nations, commissioned by the United States, and a year later, 132 nations came together and signed the international treaty to ban land. 96, it was Jody Williams who had spearheaded the organization of the NGO community that got the Nobel Peace Prize. And now, 10 years later, there's been over 10 million landmines that have been rid from the earth simply
yeah.
because one person reinvented government
mm-hmm.
and brought in the NGO communities in an extraordinarily new way of redefining democracy.
Mm-hmm.
If we in America, who pioneered representative government in the late 18th century when we built our constitutional system, if we would enter the 21st century and say that America's historic legacy is to continue to reinvent democracy in changing times, and we would really talk about governance as a verb
mm-hmm.
and bring in the stakeholders
right.
rather than government as a noun and in a kind of a static, classical notion,
mm-hmm.
we could change the world.
Yes. And on that note, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll have more conversation about how we're going to do this thing of changing the world. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back.
The health service at Keene State College has this important information about after-hour care. The College Health Service is open by appointment from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday during the academic year. To make an appointment, students may call 8-2450 from any campus phone after 8 a.m. Students with identified emergencies will be seen immediately. The health service is located on the third floor of Elliott Hall on the Keene State campus. Students requiring medical care after the health service is closed should contact or go to the Cheshire Medical Center Emergency Room. The telephone number is 354-6600. The Cheshire Medical Center Emergency Room is located at 590 Court Street in Keene. This message is brought to you by your friends at WKNH.
All right, Groove Cookies and Spoofus Goofus Aficionados. Every Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. to 10 a.m., you can groove and laugh with Michelli's Vixolodian Muse, a fine hump day blend of comedy and jams. So giggle and snicker, but keep your hands on the wheel and...
May the folks be with you always!
Okay, and we're back here with Jim Garrison. He is the author of America as Empire, Global Leader or Rogue Power. And thanks for joining us, Jim, from California.
You're welcome.
And we, before the break, we're speaking of this new civilization that we may be at the threshold of. And I'm, again, wanting your vision, your image of how this might look, how it might look for America and the world to move beyond the nation state. What kinds of organizations do you think will work to both protect the local culture and the local economies, unlike WTO and IMF policies, I might add, and give your person on the street a voice in what goes on both locally as well as in international affairs? What kind of institutions do you see needing to come into being, and how do you see those happening?
Well, one of the things I would say, particularly to those that have a trouble with the whole notion of global governance, is that if you look at the United States, one of the reasons why we're as successful as we are is that we're quite heavily regulated. I mean, we have the Security and Exchange Commission, we have the Federal Communication Commission, we have dozens and dozens of local and state and regional and federal laws and agencies that govern commerce, that govern speech, that govern entertainment, that govern almost every aspect of what we as Americans do. And we have learned that you're not either free or unfree, that there's always a relationship and a healthy dialogue between private gain and private interest and the common good and the collective good. Now, at the global level, we have plenty of room for private gain on the part of our big corporations,
mm-hmm.
but almost no countervailing instrumentalities that protect the common good.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the World Trade Organization that regulates trade and fosters trade. But we needed a global environmental organization. We need to enhance the International Labor Organization. We need an International Security and Exchange Commission. We need international tax laws.
Mm.
We need international property, intellectual property laws. In other words, as the human race and the human community globalizes, we need the same regulatory frameworks that we enjoy here as Americans, within the context of the United States. When I fly from San Francisco to Paris, I want to know that those air traffic controllers are regulated, they're speaking the same language,
mm-hmm.
and that I'm going to land safely. And the fact is that we do have a highly controlled and highly regulated international airspace regulation. That's not a diminution of my freedom. That's an enhancement of my freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And as Senator Alan Cranston pointed out just shortly before he died, he wrote a book on it called The Sovereignty Revolution. He says, sovereignty doesn't end at national borders. Sovereignty is what each community discerns appropriate to the expanse in which it has activity. So,
mm-hmm.
Each family has a certain sovereignty. And then in a city, we have sort of city government.
Mm-hmm.
We have state government. We have federal government. And the Supreme Court, in the Congress, we're always adjudicating between what decisions are made at what level. Now that the human race is globalizing, we need to put just as much attention to global governance,
mm-hmm.
As we have at national and state and local and personal governance. And the fact that we're not doing it, and that the greatest nation in the world is ridiculing global governance,
mm-hmm.
and calling it an affirmative evil, is again the largest part of America's predicament and the crisis of leadership that the rest of the international community perceives is occurring here in the United States at the moment when we need to lead in the spirit of Roosevelt and Wilson. We are relying instead on brute force and breaking down already weak international institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only a crisis, it's a tragedy.
Right. Now, you had said at some point in your book that, you know, part of our collective reaction to 9/11 was understandable, this kind of movement into a defensive posture, but in a certain sense, we have to get over 9/11 in order to move to our next phase. Can you say what it is we need to get over and how you see that happening?
I think that the president and the powers that be, as it were, in this country used 9/11 not for healing, but for legitimating a very aggressive international agenda that would have not been possible had 9/11 not happened. And that's why the majority of the world public outside the United States believes that the Bush administration had some collusion between the Bush administration and what happened on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just so conveniently was used to legitimate things that the American people would have never tolerated had that event not happened.
Well, the neoconservatives did write in the new, I guess, policy for New World Order or however that was called, they did write about the new Pearl Harbor, and there were plans on the block to actually invade Iraq before 9/11 ever happened. So there's some, I think, basis for that belief, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. It was the Project for the New American Century.
That's it, yeah.
Which was publicly accessible and laid out exactly what you say, that in order for them to achieve the invasion of Iraq, the destabilization of Iran, Syria, et cetera, that they needed a new Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why many people, in fact, there's been books written in the majority of the European and the kind of the world public out there believes that there was some collusion.
Mm-hmm.
Had we taken the advice, for example, of Mary Robinson, she was the former president of Ireland, and at the time she was the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, she says, this was not an act of terrorism. This was a crime against humanity. When George Bush called it an act of terrorism and then called for a war on terrorism, he did two things. Number one, he declared war, which is what he wanted to do, was wage war. And number two, he elevated Osama bin Laden into a warrior on the other side with whom he was doing combat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If we'd have just called it a crime against humanity, not declared war, and the United States would have really gone after him in the spirit of Nuremberg, where we went after those responsible for the Holocaust,
mm-hmm.
the world community, I think, would have banded again with us much more firmly.
Mm-hmm.
We would have never gone into this war on terrorism, terror alerts, and all the manipulation, the Patriot Act, and all the things that are creating a national security state abroad and a highly militarized domestically and a highly militarized foreign policy abroad, but we would have really focused on human rights, and maybe the President of the United States would have flown to Saudi Arabia and said, listen, let's sit together and let's understand how did this happen, and what is it that you're trying to communicate through 9/11 about your discontent with the way the United States is comporting itself in the international community at large and in the Middle East in particular. We could have had a completely different conversation. One is war-based, and the other would have been wisdom-based.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we took the path to war has led us to where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And the path not taken is the path sooner or later we have to tread.
That's right.
If we are to leave, the international community is waiting for us to do.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, perhaps one of the last things we can touch in on here, I wish we had more time, but this is such a rich conversation. I have so much gratitude for your joining us today. But one of the things you talk about is the American debt that we have for things that we've done in the past, much of which I think the American populace is not really aware of, things we've done in Iran and Iraq and Chile and Nicaragua and other places. As president of Wisdom University, what would you say about how we balance this karma, and how do you see us moving forward from this point with a little bit more humility than we've had in the past, and how do we also break this news to the many people who, for whom it would be news, that we've been perpetrators of a tremendous amount of violence over the last 40 and 50 years?
Well, I think this is a great point to end on. You know, the ultimate irony of the United States is that we are a country that 230, 40 years ago was founded as a haven for those seeking escape from the abuse of power. That's why people came from all over the world to American shores.
Mm-hmm.
We have now become the nation that is exercising more power over others than any nation in history. And so we have become our opposite. And we need to remember what Lord Acton said at the end of the 19th century, and that is that power corrupts.
Mm-hmm.
And absolute power corrupts absolutely. The massive amount of American power over the last 50 years has caused a real corruption of American power and a corruption of the American psyche and soul. We've become mass consumerist.
Mm-hmm.
And we're addicted to television and violence and sexuality through entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And we are comporting ourselves in Iraq in a way that is a humiliation to our rich legacy, but we don't even know that we're doing it. That's mm-hmm. how out of touch that we are. I believe that if America would reconnect with the wisdom traditions and understand that, as Benjamin Franklin said, our destiny is not about power, it's about light. I believe that we would reconnect very quickly. We're a great people. We have a very rich heritage. The genius of our constitutional system is unsurpassed in the annals of history. And I believe that we're going through a rough patch with, you know, a president that has an extremely uncomplicated mind and therefore is susceptible to dark forces and fears,
mm-hmm.
which you can see in his eyes when he speaks.
Yeah.
And this too will pass, mm-hmm. and our institutions are strong. And those of us who are dedicated to the wisdom tradition need to spend this time in the political wasteland, really deepening our spiritual connectedness mm-hmm. with each other, with the earth, with our religious traditions, whatever they may be, because there's going to come up another choice point, like November last year, where I think we made a fundamentally wrong mistake for which we're going to pay. But there's going to be other choice points, and if we'll have all done our homework and really filled out this whole notion of what I call mystical activism,
mm-hmm.
I believe that wisdom will return to the corridors of power.
Indeed. Thank you. And for those of you who may want to get more information about Wisdom University, do you have a website or any
just
other?
Just come to wisdomuniversity.org.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we have been speaking with Jim Garrison, the president of Wisdom University in California and the author of America as Empire, Global Leader or Rogue Power, as well as many other books. And, Jim, we really thank you for being here with us this evening and really helping to open us our eyes to what's going on in the world and what we can do about it. It's a hopeful vision.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much.
Be well.
All right. You too.